there, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd. So, today, it was my pick, and it's really fantastic, I've got to say, to be talking about The Abyss, especially after last week's episode, since this one, it's really a close encounter of the oceanic kind, so we've got that nice little relationship there. There's just so many similarities between this movie and Close Encounters. And as the cliche goes, we know more about the surface of Mars than the bottom of our own ocean. Now, in The Abyss, here's what the plot's like. We've got a crew of saturation divers with an undersea habitat. They're called into action by the U.S. Navy when a nuclear submarine sinks nearby. They need to work with a SEAL team to figure out what the heck happened. As they investigate, there's a cascading series of calamities occurring, which is, you know, pretty typical for James Cameron's style. And the military gets involved and some of their procedures get in the way. But then, when all seems lost, something amazing happens. We get first contact with an alien civilization, or at least alien to us, at the bottom of the sea.
Hey, Ace, you done impressing yourself?
No way that thing could just be seawater.
They must have learned to control water. I mean, at a molecular level. You know, they can plasticize it, they can polymerize it, do whatever they want to do with it. They can put it under intelligent control.
Maybe their whole technology is based on that. Controlling water.
So that's The Abyss. Where did you first encounter this one, Catherine?
That would have been last week. I've never
always
seen
nice to have a fresh perspective.
Yeah, I've never seen The Abyss before. I'd heard of it. I kind of mixed it up with other movies that were kind of around in the 80s, but I do not recall ever seeing this until I downloaded it and watched it just a week ago. So it's brand new to me. What's your history with it, John?
Yeah, I ran into this one in grad school. I remember watching it late at night. It's one of those movies that benefits from being watched late at night, I think. Mm. And I have to say, I just remember that resuscitation scene. It felt like it went on forever.
It did go on. It did go on forever.
Yeah.
We should mention that I watched the extended version of this movie, which is almost 3 hours long. It really is almost like two movies smashed together. It just went on forever. I think, John, you watched a slightly shorter version, right?
That's right. I watched a version that was on a streaming service that I have. And I think that one was about 2 hours and 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, that was the theatrical release. I guess there were some parts to it, though, that James Cameron really did want to keep in, but the studio was asking him for a shorter movie, so they ended up releasing the shorter version to the theaters. But there's a whole bunch of extra stuff in the extended version that goes on for almost 3 hours. And I guess it's more like the director's cut. It's the movie that James Cameron wanted to make. But man, is it long. My daughter came in while I was watching it, sat down for about 15 minutes, declared she was bored, and then left. And this is a kid who loves Avatar, so like she likes James Cameron movies, but not this one.
Yeah, it'd be interesting, right? Because Cameron does tend to edit for action, for keeping that level high. And there are some points in this one where maybe he doesn't quite achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, when I watched it the first time, it was good enough. It was just a bit long, right? I think the problem is, like I said, it is almost like two different movies that he tried to combine into one really long movie. Call it a mash of Close Encounters meets The Hunt for Red October, right? It's, you start off and it's sort of like this claustrophobic submarine movie and all the military intrigue. And then like the second half of the movie is more, oh, wow, we met aliens. And now let's interact with the aliens and talk about how humans need to change and love each other more. And I don't know, it's kind of disparate. And I'm not sure why he chose to put those two ideas together.
I can see how that fit together in his head, but I think you're right. The glue between those two might not be as strong as you like. Maybe you've got to not epoxy things together while they're underwater.
Yeah, and this whole movie was like shot underwater. We'll talk about this later, but it sounds like it was an exhausting movie to film, and I'm very glad I was not involved in that. Can you imagine filming, like, as an actor, just filming underwater all day, every day?
Oh my goodness.
I mean, I love diving, but that might be a bit much for me.
I just imagine the claustrophobia, right? Like just watching the scenes where you've got Ed Harris there with his, you know, helmet full of what we're told is the breathing fluid, but instead it's actually just colored water.
Yeah.
He's got to do this scene. Then he's got to get into the water wearing, you know, a full fishbowl on his head.
And act. I would just be freaking out and afraid I would drown. And there were a couple of cases, I think, where he did almost drown. So does not sound like a fun movie to make.
It's true, but at least we have James Cameron here practicing his water skills.
For
that
sure.
He uses quite a bit later on.
Yeah, no, I don't know why James Cameron was so obsessed with the ocean, but it's a through line throughout his career, right? I mean, starting with this idea that he turned into a movie, he both wrote and directed this movie. And then, of course, in 2012, he visited the deepest point on Earth, one of only a handful of people who have done that, only the third person to do it in history. And then later on with the Titanic, right? That movie, and then all the exploration he did at the wreck of the Titanic. Yeah, it's this obsession with the ocean and what's at the bottom of the ocean seems to be something that keeps coming back in his work.
Well, somehow we're a season and a half into this, and this is our very first James Cameron movie.
Oh, is
so
it?
Let's just. I think so. So let's just go ahead and dive into the science grapes. You see what I did there?
Yes.
All right. Go right ahead, Catherine. What really stuck out to you?
Well, maybe we should talk about our history with diving. John, have you ever done any open water diving?
No.
Okay. So I am actually a certified diver, although I haven't done it in over a decade, but I am both a PADI open water diver and advanced open water diver certified. I have 50 dives under my belt. So I know a little bit about diving. And that was the thing I thought was relatively unrealistic about this movie. The fact that, you know, they have all these divers under 2,000 feet of water at minimum, apparently scuba diving at the bottom of the ocean. For an advanced open water diver, which is just a recreational diver, you're limited to 100 feet, right? Which is a lot less than 2,000 feet. And there are reasons for this, right? There are problems that happen when you start diving at depth for long periods of time. First of all, you just run out of air with scuba diving. You know, air gets compressed as you go deep. And so I've done a couple of dives at 100 feet and your air only lasts for a few minutes and then you have to surface. And then as you surface, you have to go really slow to avoid the effects of decompression illness. Basically, when you breathe the air, right, you're breathing both oxygen and nitrogen. And then as you ascend, that nitrogen comes out as bubbles and can cause what's colloquially known as the bends, right? So you have to go slow so that nitrogen has time to diffuse into your bloodstream. There's other issues like you can get nitrogen narcosis when you're down really low. The nitrogen you're breathing in can make you quite silly. And when I was doing my advanced open water certificate, they actually had us do this exercise where you end up reciting the alphabet backwards, both on land and then again at 100 feet, just to show how much slower your brain is working at depth. And this is, again, only 100 feet. The abyss was at 2,000 feet. To go lower, you need to start introducing other gases. So typically this was helium. You would mix the oxygen with helium, heliox, so you avoid some of these issues with nitrogen, and you go a little bit deeper that way. But there are limits to the depths you can go. And the deepest a scuba diver has ever gone is about 1,000 feet. And this was a tricky thing to do. I think that the diver himself suffered from some issues with that, this high pressure nervous system syndrome that we'll talk about later. So it's just very complicated to dive at those depths. And I don't feel like they addressed it at all. It just looked like they were scuba diving in a tank of water, which is what they were actually doing, not trying to deal with all the effects you have when you're trying to dive at a depth of 2,000 feet. Which basically, if you do want to do that, you need a specialized diving suit, which none of them had. So I don't know, John, what did you think of all this?
Well, it's the interesting thing, right? So you've got a lot of experience with that open water diving. I don't have a lot of experience with diving. I actually only learned to swim about the last time that you did your last dive. And what I have, I think, coming into this is I have a real fascination with saturation diving, which is what this really is. But you're right, they don't show it that much, right? The only indication that this is saturation diving is when they go down in the submersible and they get on board and they have to become pressurized at that point. But saturation diving is this really complicated, really technical, really dangerous profession that gets done. Often it's associated with oil rigs, with maintaining the equipment on the seafloor. And you spend time on board ship in a pressurized environment. You go down to the seafloor in a pressurized environment, and then you only open things up when things have all equalized. And you spend 24 hours acclimatizing to all this. And at that point, coming back to regular pressure is catastrophic. Like you, for instance, we're talking about nitrogen narcosis, right? Getting the bends, you know, getting a little silly. For these people, coming up too fast is instantly fatal. Like yeah. There was a disaster actually back in the 80s. I wrote it down somewhere, but I'm not finding it right now. So I'll tell you what I remember. There was a case in which there was an accident in which the pressurized environment was depressurized instantly. Somebody opened a door that they weren't supposed to.
Oh, no.
And what happened was that the change in pressure, that drastic change in pressure that happened instantaneously, some of the people were killed by being thrown around, but everybody in there was killed basically by having the lipids in their blood denature and turn solid and basically stop their circulation.
Yikes. Yeah, that sounds awful. Yeah, there are other issues that happen at depth too. Even if you're not scuba diving, even if you're just holding your breath, you can really harm yourself. So I looked into like free diving. So this is where people just dive without any air, right? Just whatever they can hold in their lungs. But I figured at some point, like your lungs are going to collapse due to the pressure. And so this is something called lung squeeze, which does happen to a lot of these free divers. There's so much pressure around your body that your lungs cannot hold whatever residual air is left in them. And so people will come up from these dives like spitting up blood. And again, the deepest anyone has gone in a free dive is about 850 feet. So nowhere near the depths they're talking about. Just a lot of issues would come up when you're at these depths, and I don't feel like they address them at all.
No, they don't distinguish between those three different kinds, right? Coming up fast from that depth, if you're a free diver, is what you have to do. It's not good for you, but it's what you have to do, and you're typically all right. Coming up as a scuba diver, you know, if you come up fast, it will be bad, but you'll probably live. And as a saturation diver, coming up from that depth fast would be fatal.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, right? The distinguishments here that aren't really made.
Yeah, the issue is like a free diver, you just have whatever air you started with, right? So that's fine. Your lungs aren't going to explode. You might get that lung squeeze like I talked about if you go really deep. The issue with scuba diving or any diving where you're breathing in air at depth, it's the ideal gas law, right? If you have air at a certain pressure, P times V is equal to the temperature. If pressure changes, volume has to change accordingly. So you're breathing in this deep breath of air at 100 feet. Well, if you held that air and went up to the surface, suddenly that air is going to take up a lot more volume.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to cause some problems with your lungs. So this is another reason you don't want to just ascend very suddenly from depth. And if you do, you want to keep breathing while you're doing it so your lungs don't explode. You never, ever want to hold your breath when you're scuba diving. That was one thing they kept hammering into us. Because as you go up and down, you know, the volume is going to change, and that can really cause some problems.
Oh, yeah. And there's more oxygen available in that as well, which creates some weird things. Like, I think if folks who aren't involved in the industry have much familiarity with saturation diving, it's probably through the documentary from 2019 and the movie from last year called Last Breath. And that talks about a disaster on the North Seabed, north of the UK, in 2012. And there's a lot of similarities to the abyss, actually. You've got a storm that knocks a ship off course, and that causes all sorts of problems with an umbilical. And you end up with one of the saturation divers who gets cut off from an air supply. You know, basically the umbilical is severed. But at the same time, each breath that you have at that kind of depth contains a lot of oxygen. And that diver actually was able to survive for a half hour after they completely ran out of oxygen without any brain damage.
Hmm. There are systems called rebreathers. So basically, you take in oxygen when you breathe, but you also expel a lot of oxygen when you breathe out. Mm. And so you can reuse this to extend your time at depth. But in that situation, you would not see any bubbles, right? Because you're reusing your breath.
Yes.
And all the divers in this movie, you know, you can clearly see the bubbles coming out of their tanks, which is an open system like scuba. And there's no way that would work. You would run out of air so quickly at these depths, not to mention all the other issues we just talked about. So I mean, as I mentioned earlier, they did film this like in a big tank of water. I think it was, you know, on the order of like 50 feet deep. I think most of the actors stayed at about 30 feet. The benefit of 30 feet is you can ascend like rapidly if you need to and not suffer any consequences. There, you're only under another one atmosphere of pressure for a total of two. So that's okay. But it was very clear that they were just doing that. I mean, it looked like one of the dives I did, you know, in Puerto Rico, learning how to dive, and not something you would do at 2,000 feet. So, yeah, I mean, and James Cameron, all the cast and crew were certified divers. I don't know why they didn't address this at all. It seems like an oversight.
Sorry, James. We know too much this episode.
Right. What was your biggest concern with this movie, John? What stood out to you?
There's a whole bunch of things. I think, like you were noting earlier, it has to do with that glue between the alien side, or at least the non-terrestrial intelligences, by which I mean not on the land intelligences. There's a few bits and pieces with that, like the whole descending down to 25,000 feet. We may argue a little bit about 2,000 feet, but I think we are both, you know, together, you and I, on dives to 25,000 feet in any kind of apparatus, right?
Right.
So you've got things like that. You've got the manipulation of water, I think, by the aliens. That, I think there's a lot of challenges with that. Like, you notice that they use the word polymerization in there.
Yes.
Which you can't do with water. It's not the kind of molecule that does that. We're talking about carbon compounds when we're talking about polymerization and making big long chains.
Yeah, it was like, would a water polymer just be ice? Right? Like, what do they mean by that? So, yeah, there was all this, I call it the magical water, right? So there's this scene where this water tentacle comes out of the moon pool and goes, like, opens doors to find the people and to talk to them. I mean, cool effect for the time. And I think they reused some of those same effects later on in Terminator 2 for the T-1000. But it doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, even if aliens wanted to manipulate water, I don't know how they would do that. There's just not enough tension for it to stay coherent without some magical polymer that doesn't make sense. I don't know if you guys have seen the show or the movie Moana, but there's similarly magical water in that movie. And it reminded me a lot of that. But that's a Disney movie, right? They're not trying to explain it scientifically. It's just for fun. So yeah, I did not like the magical water, or, you know, and they're like trying to explain it scientifically when it's just magic, right? Don't try to explain it scientifically. It's never going to work.
Yeah, there's whole challenges there. Like, even if you accept that the aliens are able to, or, the undersea creatures are able to control water to the point where they can make it form shapes in air, you know, this tentacle is really long and
really
there's nothing
long
that's supporting it.
Yep.
And it's got to open doors, and water doesn't exert a lot of friction. Very difficult to apply the forces to get the handle to move.
Maybe they had magical fingers, magical water fingers.
There you go. It needs to like pick up a chamois or something, and you put that on there. I don't know. There's definitely some challenges with those sorts of things. They create an atmosphere when Ed Harris goes and visits their little city. I don't know. There's a lot of strangeness to this particular civilization.
Right.
And I think one thing that I want to understand a little bit better, and I'm curious how you feel about this, one of the pivotal points to add tension, and like I said at the start, the thing that I remembered from this from earlier, I'd actually forgotten about the aliens at the bottom, I have to say, but I remembered the resuscitation scene, right? And as I go to rewatch it, I'm remembering that I didn't really understand why Lindsay had to die.
Like, right.
Isn't there buddy breathing?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's one thing you learn as a certified diver is if somebody's you have two regulators on every, so they might not even have had to have buddy breathe. And if something fails, that's right. You do this buddy breathing where you'll take the regulator, breathe a few breaths, you pass it to your buddy, they take a few breaths, and you just go back and forth. I mean, maybe he didn't have enough oxygen to support two people, but it wasn't a super far swim, so that seems unlikely.
No.
The bigger hazard there would probably be hypothermia, which they also did not address. Well, I guess they addressed it in this scene. That was the whole point. She was going to go into hypothermic shock, basically, and that would slow down her metabolism so she could be later revived. But when Ed Harris and his buddy Kat are diving between the different modules in the station, right, they're also, like, in short sleeves, half naked, in this near-freezing water. And except for one scene where Ed Harris kind of shivers a little Like, they would have been hypothermic, right? And they would not have been able to fight off a trained Navy SEAL after submerging themselves in this freezing cold ocean water. So, yeah, hypothermia was a much bigger issue for them, I think, than the air. As you point out, they could have shared.
And I feel like just watching this, I feel like I was getting a little bit exhausted just by seeing Ed Harris not have any sleep and do physical feat after physical feat after physical feat. Like, I'm starting to think, okay, this is beyond human endurance to just like keep pushing like this.
Well, we talked about that during The Expanse, right? Maybe he's got some implant like Clarissa Mao.
Though that didn't last very long. This is the extended release version or something.
That's right.
And also with that same scene, like with that resuscitation scene, since I first watched this movie, I've done wilderness training, right? Like wilderness first aid training. And I think you've got this as well. And something that I think, you know, most movies do badly, and this movie does kind of badly as well, is getting across the idea that CPR is a life-saving technique, but it's also very violent.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And she's up and moving around and seems fine like 10 minutes afterwards, which you would not be.
Yeah, I mean, Ed Harris probably broke a couple of ribs, right? Doing the CPR incorrectly and probably unnecessarily, right? This whole scene was, yeah, just kind of embarrassing. Like, first of all, she's soaking wet. You can't shock somebody when they're soaking wet. And they kind of like, oh, okay, we'll push the clothes aside. But they don't try to dry her off at all. So you risk electrocuting everybody this way. And then when the shocks aren't working, Ed Harris is like, I'm going to do CPR. But like, that's way, you know, it's not as effective as the defibrillator, right? You wouldn't use just manual CPR if the defibrillator is available. And he's not doing it correctly. You're supposed to do 30 solid chest presses and then two breaths. And he's like, I don't know, just kind of, I mean, he's spazzing out a little bit, right? He's freaking out. His wife is dying. Yeah. But yeah, this was not good CPR. And then the thing that finally wakes her up is him slapping her, which again is not standard CPR practice. So yeah, this whole scene was pretty unrealistic. Although people can be revived, and we'll talk about this in Science Shine, especially when they've been drowned in cold water. So that part wasn't unrealistic. It was just the way they portrayed the CPR scene was pretty unrealistic.
Well, maybe he was just using his magic ring, right? Because there's a scene earlier where he keeps a hydraulic door open by sticking his ring with his finger inside of it in the door. And this is a door that's closing, that's meant to divide chambers, that's meant to hold tons of water pressure. So I don't know, that was kind of ridiculous. Though kudos to the continuity people that they keep Ed Harris's hand blue for the rest of the
movie. I noticed that as well. I'm like, props to them. Because, yeah, sometimes you'll just see his hand and it's just lightly blue and you're like, oh, they remembered. Oh, good. Yeah. Apparently nobody liked this scene, though. The actress who plays Lindsay was so put out. She like stormed off the set, cried, we're not animals, and wouldn't come back until like a couple people had to go and talk to her and coax her back to doing the scene. In one case, I think Ed Harris is just wailing away on a sandbag because she was like not participating anymore. And you can see why, right? I mean, even his sort of half-hearted CPR has still got to be pretty uncomfortable for somebody to endure for that long.
And Cameron, of course, is known as a bit of a perfectionist. They probably did that scene more than once.
Well, I think what happened was like they did the scene and it was fine, but there was like they ran out of film or there was a camera blocking an actor or something. And so they kept having to do it over and over again. And she was just fed up. I mean, it sounds like this whole film was just kind of a disaster to film because of the conditions and James Cameron's perfectionism and, you know, the potential for drowning. People were very exhausted and at the end of their rope, understandably.
So scientifically, is there anything else you want to really highlight?
Okay, not to let the aliens off the hook just yet. There were a couple other things about them that bothered me. First of all, their ship, right? When we finally see it, it doesn't look like the sort of ship that could easily enter the Earth's atmosphere, right? I feel like there's no clear heat shield or anything that would allow it to enter. It probably would have fallen apart if it tried to enter the Earth's atmosphere. So that begs the question, like, how did it get there? Or are they native to Earth? They do address this like very briefly in a conversation where they're like, are they from here? Are they from, are they aliens? And they're like, oh, I think they're aliens. And then they drop it and they don't talk about it. But as you said, you know, there's a lot we don't know about the bottom of the ocean. So who knows what's down there in a lot of ways. So could there be weird aliens that evolve on Earth? And well, I guess they wouldn't be aliens, but, you know, creatures that evolve on Earth in the depths of the ocean. They don't address that. And then they seem able to mess with the humans' power supply, not unlike the aliens we met last week. How do they do that? They've like never really encountered humans before. How do you turn off a flashlight and then turn it back on again?
It's a good thing there's no railroad signs at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, they'd be jiggling around. So there are some callbacks to Close Encounters with that. And then lastly, I don't know if this was in the version you saw, John, but they're like talking to Ed Harris and explaining why. So at the end in the extended version, they have this huge tidal wave that's like going to kill everybody on Earth or anyone near the coastline. And they just stop it while Ed Harris is talking to them. And he's like, what's going on? You know, why are you doing this? And they're like, oh, well, you guys just keep trying to kill each other. So it's sort of, you know, a war kind of humans bad, don't do war analogy there. And he's like, well, why did you stop the wave? And it's because he had like sacrificed himself to like disarm the nuke and save them. And in one of his last communications, he's told his wife that he loved her, you know. And they're like, okay, well, most humans are bad, but you're good. So you're redeemable. So we're not going to kill you all with this giant tidal wave. But A, how do they understand English? And B, especially a higher concept like love, right? How do they know what he's saying? And they just don't address this. Did you see that part in the shortened version?
When you initially said that, my reaction was, what now?
Okay, so it wasn't in the theatrical release.
No. The theatrical release, he goes down to 25,000 feet to the bottom of the Cayman Trench. And he cuts the wire.
Yep.
They whisk him off to their little city. They create this very 2001 style bubble for him.
Yes,
to
I saw that. Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of very pixelated text because it's also the 80s for the aliens.
Yeah.
And then everybody goes to the surface and nobody dies. And they acknowledge the MacGuffin by saying, we should be dead from decompression, but we're not.
Yeah, that was also pretty magical. Magical water, magical decompression, magical power.
I do like it better, though, I have to say, if the aliens are Earth life, right? I think that's more interesting than if you had aliens from another planet that decided to go down to the bottom of the ocean. That was their natural habitat. I mean, there's interesting stuff there, but I don't know. I kind of like the idea of sentient sea creatures. So the thing that was always in the back of my mind with the movie was, could you actually evolve a technological civilization at the bottom of the
mm-hmm,
ocean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's relevant to like the exploration of ocean worlds. You know, we've talked about life living in Europa's subsurface ocean, for example. Is that even possible? With Europa, I think there's some other issues, but it's certainly something people are talking about. For example, did you know that if you're deep enough, shells won't form? Like calcium can't precipitate to make a shell, which isn't really an issue in our ocean, but it could be an issue for other oceans.
I was going to say, you know, they didn't seem to have many hard parts in these particular.
It's true. You know, well, we don't know. Yeah, I guess Lindsay pokes it and it's kind of squishy.
But you're right. It is a fascinating question, right? Like what I've sort of heard here is that if you've got enough oxygen to have the kinds of creatures that are like us, then at the bottom of the ocean, you probably don't have much in the way of reduced metals to work with. And you can't make fire, so it's hard to process those metals. It's also hard to get calories out of your food. Like one of the big revolutions in terms of life on Earth has been the ability of fire to get more out of the same amount of material. And kind of my favorite argument here, though it's the least scientific, is the psychological one, right? Without the night sky to wonder about, is exploration something that a creature, even if they were sentient, would think about?
Well, I don't think it's impossible, though. From my understanding, when James Cameron went to the bottom of the ocean, the Mariana Trench, the deepest point on Earth, they did actually see fish, which I was pretty shocked to learn. I figured it would just be all microbes down there. But no, there's complex life, even in the deepest parts of the ocean. And so it's not a huge stretch to think that a fish could eventually become sentient. Maybe it couldn't form a spaceship because of the issues you identified, but I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility.
Oh, no, absolutely not that you could have life down there. You know, life finds a way, as we said a few episodes ago. And, you know, it is interesting, right? Because the technology that they have is very impressive, right? Like the difference in pressure going from the bottom of the ocean, the bottom of the Cayman Trench to the surface is more than the pressure change that we have going to the full vacuum of space from the surface of the Earth. So they really are assumed to have this incredible control over pressure and therefore temperature and all this, even though, as you pointed out, Catherine, they're their spaceships, their aqua ships, whatever you want to call them. They're very organic looking, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it looked like one of their little submersibles, I don't know what to call it, looked like a manta ray. Another one looked kind of like a jellyfish, right? They were clearly playing off of these ideas of submarine life. And the ship itself, yeah, also looked somewhat organic. It didn't, like I said, look like it would survive entry into the Earth's atmosphere. I'm not even sure there was any metal on it at all, right? So very different style than you'd expect for those pressures.
It's true, although the one place I think that organic stuff is a little misplaced is near the edge of the drop-off. I did see some green fronds. There's no photons there. Mm. You can get deep-sea corals, but you can't get plants.
I also noticed they had plants in their little submersible living space. Like, where were they getting light? Those poor plants are probably going to die pretty soon.
Oh, definitely. Assuming that the crew doesn't die from electrocution or fire.
That's right. Yeah, it just baffled me when the whole thing floods and they're in ankle deep water and there's like electrical outlets everywhere. Like, how is nobody getting electrocuted? I would not want to be in a flooded ship like that. I would avoid the water for sure.
So anything else you want to touch on before we go to Science Shot?
Yeah, just one thing. So they make a huge point of naming the hurricane that's causing all this problem at the surface, which eventually disconnects the umbilical and causes all them to get dragged over the edge of this trench. And they very clearly name it Frederick. They even make a joke about, oh, hurricanes should be named after women. Haha. We'll get to the misogyny later. But it turns out that there was a Hurricane Frederick in 1979, and it was so bad that they retired the name. Right. So if a hurricane is large enough and causes enough devastation, they will just never use it again. I think, you know, to protect the people who are perhaps injured or hurt in that encounter. So Frederick had already been used 1979. The meteorologists decided not to use it anymore. And actually, this was the first year, 1979 was the first year they began assigning both female and male names to cyclones. And yeah, this one was so bad, they never used it again. So unless this movie took place in 1979, and there's reason to believe it did not, this would not have been Hurricane Frederick. It's also unclear what date this movie actually took place in, because we see several different timestamps on different videos. One is January 1987, which is probably when this was filmed, would be my guess. But they also show another one that shows January 18th, 1994. Which, okay, they're like, okay, I guess we're going to set this in the future, 5 years in the future, because this came out in 1989, where we might have an experimental platform like this. So it's not clear what year this was. I don't think it was 1979. So this hurricane should have had a different name.
Well, out of all the mushiness, I think there are some really good things here, too. So tell you what, dear listener, we'll be back in just a minute with the Science Shine. All right, welcome back. So this is the part of the show where we talk about the things that we like. And there's a few missteps. We had, a healthy science gripe section, but there are some really neat things, I think, that they got right. And Catherine, was there anything that stuck out to you here for some kudos?
Yeah, I've got to start with the fluid breathing, which when I saw it, I was like, there is no way this is real, right? This seems crazy. But when I looked it up, it turns out it's actually a thing. And in fact, those rats they had in the movie were actually breathing liquid. And this upset like animal rights activists so much that they didn't show that scene in the UK. And the American Humane Association rated this film as unacceptable because they put this rat in this oxygenated fluid and made the rat breathe the fluid. You can tell like it's really struggling to do it. And I think at one point the rat's handler, Hippie, was like, she's doing it, she's not liking it, you know, and that's clearly what's happening to this poor rat. But yeah, this was the whole idea actually that triggered this movie was James Cameron saw a talk by one of the scientists who was working on this whole idea of fluid breathing. And that's what inspired him to write a short story when he was a teenager, which eventually became The Abyss years later.
It leaves an impression, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it has been used in humans, not as extensively as in animals, but they've done some tests with humans. I think they want to use it for medical reasons, probably less so the diving, you know, reasons that they showed in this film. Because again, it's really hard to get that fluid in and out of your lungs. You probably can't do it, you know, for long periods of time under the ocean. It'd probably be work better in a medical setting with a mechanical ventilator. But yeah, but people have tried it out on humans too. They could treat premature babies or adults with respiratory distress. It kind of hasn't gone anywhere as far as I know since then, but it's a really interesting idea that was backed by actual scientific data.
Fascinating that the rat was a bit of a method actor here, actually breathing the fluid. But Ed Harris, we have to emphasize, was not. His helmet in those scenes is actually full of pink water. And I don't know, it's just so terrifying to
terrifying.
Watch that.
Yeah, yeah. At one point, like I think I said earlier, they were trying to get him a regulator so he could breathe in between takes, and the regulator wasn't working. And so he nearly drowned, and Cameron just kept filming. And he was so frustrated that when he got to the surface, so the story goes, he punched James Cameron and then drove home sobbing. So, I mean, this movie sounds like a really tough one to film. You know, like I can't imagine any actors like, I want to drown today doing my job as an actor, right? It should not be one of the hazards of this particular job.
No, no. But they did have a lot of appropriate equipment. Like one thing that James Cameron loves to focus on is the tech, I think. And you notice that the subs that they actually had, maybe they weren't in 2,000 feet of water, but they were realistic subs for underwater activities that they were using.
Yeah, just little details like the rig clearly had plenty of hatches so you could section off different portions of it if one of them flooded, which they did. You know, it's kind of like a spaceship. I think we noted this too with like Battlestar Galactica, how the Battlestar Galactica had all sorts of hatches to guard against any leaks. And they did the same thing here. They also have realistic communication styles. At one point, their handlers on the surface say, oh, let's switch to the UQC. Which is a type of underwater acoustic communication. This was after they lost their umbilical, which I assume is how they were originally communicating. And they're like, well, shoot, we can't use the umbilical anymore. Let's switch to this acoustic communication, which is a real thing. The U stands for general utility. The Q stands for sonar, meaning they use sound to communicate. And then the C is two-way communications. So they've used this to communicate with naval ships, is my understanding. So that's a real thing. So, you know, there's a lot of little details here, the tech that seem realistic. John, you also talked about the scene where they have to pressurize. They do acclimatize to it, and they have that nice conversation about the high-pressure nervous syndrome, which is also a real thing. And just as they claim, you know, it does cause issues like tremors, psychological disorders. This is mostly because of helium. So it's like helium poisoning, I guess, is some of the issues. So that's all realistic as well.
Yeah, and with the oxygen poisoning, you actually do get these tonic-clonic convulsions, which you see the actor portraying in the film. So there's a lot of that sort of thing where it's clear that James Cameron has talked to somebody in the know about these things. So it's always nice to see. I think you notice that they tap with a wrench to make sure that they're not going to flood a compartment to see if there are people
right.
You know, able to respond. Cameron always does the little things right.
Yeah, magical aliens, we'll just take that as a given, but we're going to make sure this rig has a bunch of hatches.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned that scene where they do the pressurization. It's thin, but it's that one indication of what actually is going on here. Because in the last section, we talked about free diving versus scuba diving versus saturation diving. That actually sets it up as saturation.
Yeah, I like that it gave a coffee, the SEAL guy who got a bit crazy, rationale for why he was doing what he was doing, right? Because you needed a bad guy for this movie. And in this case, it was the U.S. military. But why was he doing what he was doing? And you can explain it through this high-pressure nervous syndrome, right? It was causing a neurological disorder that made him exceedingly paranoid in a way that he might have not have been otherwise. And then there would have been no conflict. But he was affected by this syndrome, and that caused all the other chaos that happened later on.
Definitely. In terms of other things that come back to me, one thing that you might worry about, dear listener, is how do you hide a city full of NTIs on the bottom of the ocean? And it turns out the bottom of the ocean is a very big place. It's not very well surveyed. So things like that are not all that surprising. I mean, we've been searching for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 for how many years now?
Yeah.
And a 777 is not a small object either. So it's very difficult to find big things like that. So this is an area that I don't know if they were intending to do well, but they did it well anyway.
I saw a talk about underwater mining not too long ago. I'm in an earth science department, so we have a lot of economic geologists, and they were talking about, could we mine the seafloor? Turns out it's not very economically viable, thank goodness, because I don't really want us mining the seafloor. The speaker showed some images of the bathymetry, the topography of the ocean floor, and there's this place on Google Earth you can find where there's all these like stripes. And people are like, oh, is it aliens on the ocean floor? It's no, they just happen to do a survey there. So there's higher resolution data. Most of the ocean floor is just not as well surveyed as that one particular patch that you can see as stripes in Google Earth.
It is fascinating, though. A lot of resources down there. Like, I imagine this was the manganese nodules. And there's 2 trillion tons of methane that's thought to be sitting in clathrates on the seafloor, too.
Yeah, this was, I think, more sulfates and metals.
Oh.
Different, like more like mining, like that you'd see on the surface for precious metals.
Oh, like real mining?
Real mining. Yeah, yeah. Turns out, yeah, that there's not either not enough of it or it's not concentrated enough to be economically viable. So people have tried a little bit to do this, but it doesn't seem like it's something that's going to go forward. At least I hope not.
That's true. In talking about the economic aspect of it as well, I was interested to see that the whole reason that Ed Harris and that whole group is down there is not to go and rescue submarines, right? They're there actually to do work on oil rigs, which is how this kind of diving, this kind of service is actually taking place in the real world. So they do represent that industry fairly well, I think.
Yeah, I guess James Cameron, his original story was about a bunch of scientists doing science at the bottom of the ocean, but realized that nobody was interested in the lives of scientists. Sorry, John. and
oh, darn.
and changed it to oil rig folks who you know, more every man that he thought would be a more appealing to the general audience. So that's why he made the switch, just to make it more appealing to folks in the theater.
At the same time, I do not get the Armageddon vibe.
That's true. This is better than Armageddon. This is way better than Armageddon. That was so silly. I mean, because here we have, I don't know to call them miners, oil riggers? What do you call them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, like, they're almost roughnecks, but these people are skilled and they're smart, whereas I kind of feel like, you know, I wouldn't let the roughnecks from Armageddon near my oil rig.
Right, but these folks are using equipment they know. They're on their turf, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. Unlike Armageddon, where they try to turn oil riggers into astronauts, right? Like, you can't just teach somebody in a week how to fly a shuttle, right? That's crazy. But these folks are on their, using their gear in their environment. That seems much more realistic.
That's fair.
Yeah, and let's go back to that scene where they revive Lindsay, speaking of our cast and crew. So we had some gripes about it, not the most realistic revival scene, but it is possible. She was right in saying, you know, if I drown in cold water, you have a good chance of reviving me. If you have a heart attack and you need to be revived at normal temperatures, you probably only have a few minutes before you get extensive brain damage without oxygen. But there have been folks who have drowned in cold water that have been found half an hour later and have been revived. I think the idea is that the cold like slows down your metabolism, so your body doesn't need as much oxygen, so you can be revived and suffer few ill effects, at least from your brain. Your ribs might be crushed, but you know, your brain will still work. There was a case of a 3-year-old girl who fell into a fish pond at 46 degrees Fahrenheit, and it took, I think, almost 2 hours to resuscitate her. But when she was warm enough, her heart started again, and she didn't seem to suffer any ill effects. So it was dramatized, but the concept is correct, that you could revive somebody who drowned in cold water.
Yeah, I just remember from the TV show House, you know, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
Yeah.
And the water down at the base of the continental shelf, which is where this is taking place, is very cold. It's, you know, pretty much freezing or colder down there. So definitely the hypothermia thing you can do. So long as your salt levels don't get messed up, we learned that from the medical drama, The Pit. They also have a girl who drowns in a pool, and they warm her up 2 hours later. But being the Pit, they have to kill her instead of letting her survive.
Yeah. Well, if it was House, she'd have lupus, so.
Exactly.
Anyways, good old medical dramas. One other thing I noticed that was pretty close to correct was how they described the sub that had sunk. So this sub doesn't actually exist, or at least it didn't exist at the time of this filming. The USS Montana was not entered into service until, I think, 2022. So this sub was fictional. But it did have sort of the right number of missiles for a sub of its class. So they said it has 24 Trident missiles with 8 MIRVs per missile. A MIRV is a multiple independently targeted reentry vehicle, so basically a warhead. And this is about right. You know, similar subs do carry 24 ballistic missiles. Now, they typically have multiple warheads. So probably that warhead that they took out had more than one palm on it. Yay. And they said it had a 50 kilotons nominal yield, which was close, but not quite right. The bombs they probably had, which would have been the W-76 warhead, would be 100 kilotons, not 50. Close, though. And, you know, that is roughly 5 times Hiroshima, which was about 15 kilotons. So, you know, they're in the right ballpark. It's not completely exact, but they're close. The one beef I did have is you probably aren't able to carry around one of these warheads. You know, they weigh several hundred pounds. So I can't imagine one dude, even a strong Navy SEAL, could like lug around a 200 to 300 pound warhead by himself. But you know, other than that, I thought they represented the armaments of this sub pretty well.
And speaking of the nuclear weapons, I mention it only because this is like me nerding out a little bit. I do a lot of work with different colors of light in my my research. And when Ed Harris is down at 25,000 feet and tapping out really bad texts on his Casio watch, he's trying to defuse the nuclear weapon. And of course, you've got two different wires and four different colors, but he's only got access to monochromatic light. So there's just one wavelength there. And so he can't tell the difference between the two. And he has to make a guess. And I just love that. You know, a lot of these little high intensity sources, like sodium lights, like phosphorescent things, they don't give off a broad spectrum of light. And it makes it very difficult to use our color vision. So I just enjoyed that detail.
I did. I thought it was a fun detail too. Although I later read that both of the wires were black and white just so they would look exactly identical under this glowing sodium light.
It's a little bit like old Hollywood, right? Like, you know, for blood, they always used to use chocolate because it showed up better on film.
Right. And it didn't matter that it was brown because there was no color. Interesting.
Exactly.
All right. Anything else you want to say about the things the Abyss did well?
No, I'm pretty happy, I think.
All right, then we'll be back in just a second with Of Its Time. Okay, welcome back. So in this segment, we talk about the things that uniquely place this movie in the time in which it was filmed. So this movie came out August 9th, 1989, just at the end of that decade, and filming began about a year prior. So we're talking late 80s here. John, was there anything about this movie that really stood out to you that placed it in that time frame?
You know, it's interesting, right? Like, it's almost that it reminds me of other movies of its time, just like the equipment that you see, like those CRT monitors, the pixelization of things, even the aliens, you know, use that same text crawl type of thing. And I feel like there's something that feels a lot like 80s sci-fi.
Right. They also have those cassette tapes. They have a tape player and one of the submersibles playing that very excellent song, Willing, which was a cover by Linda Ronstadt from 1974. There was another great song called Too Much Pressure, which was a 1980 song. So definitely the music and the cassette tapes definitely placed it in its time. There's a good old VHS tape too, when Hippie is recording the SEALs messing with the warhead. And when Lindsay is trying to capture the pictures of the aliens, she's using an actual camera with film in it that she then later tries to process in kind of a half-hearted dark room there on the ship. So definitely, yeah, back in the days, more the analog days before everything became digital, before people had smartphones and cameras on them all the time.
It is really fascinating how you can use music like this. So you can use it to place somebody in a time. And normally that's what movies do. They will use whatever's popular at the time or in recent time periods. But I've also seen it used to really try to displace the viewer a little bit. Like you probably see this a little bit in Guardians of the Galaxy, for instance. And
right.
Recently, if you want to just like create some tension and just confuse people as to when something's taking place a little bit, I just recently watched a film from this year called Marty Supreme, which is set in 1952, but all the music is very clearly from the 80s.
Huh. That's so strange. Yeah, they certainly weren't trying to do that here. I think I thought the music was contemporary for its time, right? They call
it is,
I mean,
yeah.
They even call the character hippie because he likes so-called hippie music, right? So, which is fine, right? I mean, it's not the 80s punk rock or whatever that might have been more contemporary, but it seemed reasonable that somebody would be listening to music from the early 80s and the 70s at that time. I mean, gosh, I still listen to music from the 90s, right? So that seemed all in keeping with this.
Oh yeah, and it's the unconscious stuff too, right? Like you said, the casual misogyny, right? Which is played for laughs here. And that is less common now, thankfully. And so you don't find it quite as prevalent in movies anymore.
Yeah, I found it pretty jarring because there's only two female characters in this whole movie. And one of them, they're constantly complaining about calling the B word. You know, at one point, Coffee the Seal is like, I've been waiting to duct tape your mouth shut this whole film. They refer to her stockings. They're really ragging on her this whole movie. But I read something written by James Cameron that Lindsay was supposed to be like the emotional heart of the movie. And, you know, she's the one who's like interacting with the UFOs. She's the one who like brings Ed Harris back from the brink. Right. But they don't play it that way. You know, I thought she was going to be the villain and everyone seems to hate her, but yet she's also the emotional core of the movie. So I found that really jarring. And I think that comes out in some of my comments as I was watching it.
It's really fascinating, too, because one of the things that James Cameron is known for in his films is having strong female characters. He's definitely a
right.
fan of that. But it's interesting to see how he treats those characters in some movies like this one.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I felt like he failed in this one, although it sounds like the actress was pretty frustrated with working with James Cameron. So maybe some of that came out in the script as well. It's interesting that he was actually married to the producer of this movie, Gail Hurd, I think. So life imitating art, imitating life. And then they got divorced shortly after the film wrapped. So anyways, maybe he was taking out some of his frustrations with his own personal situation out on some of the characters here. I don't know.
Well, he definitely seems to have challenges with stable relationships in real life.
Oh, yes. I didn't look up how many times he's been married, but clearly more than
once. I thought it was about, I think it's five, if I remember
wow.
correctly.
Wow. Okay. Yep. Well, I guess if you're a perfectionist movie maker who's like on set for 80 hours a week, it doesn't lead to strong relationships.
Well, there's other items lying around as well that I think you picked out, like the Garfield stuffed toy that was in there, the digital camera. It's not a cell phone, folks. Good old Sony, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah. There were some clear cultural references, like the Garfield stuffy. Or at one point, Lindsay makes reference to Roger Ramjet, which I'd never heard of before. So I looked it up. And it turns out this was a superhero animated television series in the 60s starring this Roger Ramjet, who is some patriotic hero who saves the world with his proton energy pills. And so she's comparing Coffee to this cartoon character from the 60s, which, you know, perhaps people at the time would have recognized, right, having watched it as a kid, but as somebody who grew up in the 80s and did not watch a lot of 60s cartoons, this was a new one for me.
Wow, that I did not catch that reference at all, and probably for that reason, you know, that I was unaware of the source material on that one.
Yeah, yeah, it just stuck out to me because I'm like, who is she talking about? Did she just make that word up, or is it a real person? Turns out it's a real person, but not someone we've encountered because we're too young. The other thing I thought that made this movie very 80s was the constant referral to the Russians or the Reds as the enemy. At the start of the movie, the submarine folks think that the aliens are Russians trying to attack them. And then Coffee seems obsessed with like finding the Russians and blowing them up. And this was just a regular trope in 80s movies that whenever you needed a bad guy, it was going to be the Russians. Although ironically, the real bad guy in this movie is the US military, which is probably more accurate. I think Cameron was trying to make this idea of, oh, there's this internal threat within the group. You're turning into a monster because of your own paranoia. But it really just read as another 80s movie trying to blame the Russians for everything.
It's true. They had that little bit in the beginning, but I think that that second strand comes along. And this is something that I feel is pretty characteristic of Cameron films. Like you look at Aliens or Terminator 2 or this particular movie or even like Avatar. In each one of those cases, you've got a militaristic element that is basically forgetting some bit of what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to do it. And they're creating the conflict there in many of these cases. So he likes to explore that, I think.
Yeah, it's clearly a theme that comes up in a lot of his movies, perhaps more effectively in others than this one. And then, you know, there were the actors that really placed it in its time. I like I said, I'd never seen this movie before. I had no idea who was in it and was pretty shocked to see Chris Elliott, a very young Chris Elliott, on the Benthic Explorer. He would come to fame, I think maybe a little bit later than this movie. Obviously, he was a prominent character on the Schitt's Creek, which is a Canadian show. I imagine a lot of people have seen. And then even Ed Harris looked extremely young, although, John, you thought he was sort of stuck at 45 for decades.
Well, there's some of those actors out there, right, that, you know, some actors look younger than they are and some look older than they are. And I can think of a few, but Ed Harris is one of those actors who seems to be very good at playing somebody who's middle-aged. And it feels like he's been middle-aged since he was 21 for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's like Patrick Stewart, right? I think if you go bald early, it makes you look older than you are. But I knew Ed Harris from Apollo 13, which came out, I don't know, 5 or 6 years later. And so it was just surprising to see him in this role, as a younger person than I remembered.
Oh, clearly.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention?
Sometimes we talk about what was going on around these films. And one thing that we've done lately, I think, is to look at some blockbusters, things that were really appreciated in their day by audiences. And this one is kind of interesting. It's James Cameron. It's sci-fi. It's even military sci-fi. There's that element of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It has all of the pieces, but it wasn't really appreciated well by audiences in its day. It didn't really find legs until it got to home video, really. I think this thing cost somewhere between $45 and $70 million to make, and the box office was fairly low.
It did well enough. It didn't lose money, but it didn't do that well either. And like I said, I never saw it. I mean, I was 8 years old when this came out, but it didn't make a huge impression on me. I guess we'll get to that in our final section too.
No, indeed, but it did pick up the Oscar for Best Visual Effects, which does seem warranted.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in here. You know, this very early use of CGI, you know, which would come back later in some of James Cameron's works, and obviously Jurassic Park, and then from there, everything we see today. So technically, there were some interesting things in there. I thought the acting was fine, but yeah, it clearly did not inspire people to want to go watch it multiple times at the theaters. All right, well, let's take a short pause here, and we'll come back with our ratings. We'll see you in just a moment. All right, welcome back. So this is the part of the episode where we rank the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how does it hold up over time. I've got to be honest, I forgot to do this, so I'm just trying to fill in my values right now. So you can tell I have not thought about it too much. Maybe, John, you've thought about it slightly a few more minutes longer than I have. So how would you rate this in terms of scientific accuracy?
Don't worry, I'll draw it out a little bit. Okay. Give me some time. So for the scientific accuracy, you might be surprised, dear listener, but I'm going to give this one a 4. And I think that it's not quite there, right? Like there are some big concerns that we had back in the Science Gripes section. But at the same time, I feel like when we have our really extensive Science Gripes conversations, usually that's because there's a lot that we liked about a movie. And typically it's like, you know, you notice the difference between where it is and where you want it to be, where that perfection would be. And so that gives us a lot of material to talk about. So whenever I see a big Science Gripes section, that always makes me think, okay, maybe this is towards that 4, which is what I gave it.
Yeah, I couldn't quite give it a 4 because of all the magical alien stuff that they didn't really try to explain at all. And just the diving, the unrealistic diving scenario. Those were two big things. But I was surprised at what they did do well. The fact that this fluid breathing apparatus was a real thing and they actually subjected rats to it that they showed us on film was something I did not know existed. And I would have thought it was science fiction had I not read up on it. So that was a surprise. You know, and the way they dealt with sort of the conditions you'd experience at depth, the high pressure nervous syndrome, the oxygen toxicity, even reviving somebody from cold water drowning. There were some little details here that I thought somebody had taken care to look into. But yeah, so I eventually gave it a 3.5. All right. How about its influence, John? How influential is this movie?
So this one I'm going to call a 2. So it didn't do that well at the box office. It has had more of a life on video and DVD and whatnot, but it doesn't feel like it's anybody's favorite anything, right? Like it's always listed a little ways down. So I kind of feel like it's one of those things people thought was interesting. We did talk a little bit about how like the technology to make the fluid water goes into Terminator 2 and goes into things like Deep Space Nine, but those uses are more famous than this.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's not a totally forgettable film, but it just did not have the impact that I think Cameron thought it might.
Yeah, I had to rank this pretty low. I eventually gave it a 1.5. This is almost 40 years old. I've never seen this movie. I've seen a number of James Cameron's movies, but I didn't really even know this one existed. And everything I know about its influence comes from the research I just did, those ties to later movies. But yeah, I just can't say this made a huge impact on our culture at all, given that this is something I probably should have seen and didn't. So yeah, I'm going to give it a 1.5. Sorry, James Cameron, this is not one of your better movies. We have to wait for the Blue Kitties, I guess, with Avatar. Okay, and this is, like I said, it's nearly 40 years old. So how does it hold up over that time, John?
I think it holds up remarkably well. I think that there's a lot of craft here. There are things that place it in its time, but they're not done badly, right? Like this is not like the little CRT screens that we saw in Blade Runner here that just look horrendous now. So I feel like this one is sort of middle of the road. There's some janky stuff, but by and large, you can get immersed in this one.
I agree. So John and I both gave it a 3. Definitely doesn't hold up as well as some movies I've seen, but you know, it's still a pretty gripping movie here almost 40 years later. There's not a lot there that really places in its time in a really awkward way, like you were talking about with Blade Runner. You could imagine somebody in an environment like that today. And despite my daughter thinking this was boring, you know, I mean, it still has some tension there. There's some good acting and, you know, still enjoyable to watch. Yay, these 30 some years later. So I think we're in agreement there.
Indeed.
So any final thoughts before we wrap things up here, John?
Well, I have a piece of advice for our listeners. So remember, everyone, that when you look long into an abyss, the abyss also looks into you. See you next time on Popcorn Science. Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.